Try and forget that world war, because we're starting off season two with a food fight. From Parmesan cheese to croissants to tuna jacket potatoes, make sure you eat lunch before you continue to listen, because this one will make you hungry on Seemingly Unrelated. Did you miss us? Because we did you. Welcome to season two of Seemingly Unrelated, the podcast. So nice. We premiered it twice. I am one of your three hosts. I am Jason Heat. I am a creative director, a video producer, a podcaster, and a professional wrestling creative and commentator. I'm joined as always by the man whom this whole show revolves around, the sun that we spin around, Dr. Mr. Professor Sir Andrew Johnstone.
Yes, this is Dr. Andrew Johnstone, season two, The Revenge.
Against who? We'll find out. And we are always joined by the third spoke on our tripod. She is our editor, she's our producer, and she is our Gen Z ambassador. It's Naomi!
Hello and welcome back, lovely listeners. I'm so glad to have your ears again.
And if you're not being welcomed back, if you're being welcomed for the first time, the briefest of explanations. Seemingly Unrelated is a show where Dr. Mr. Professor Sir Andrew Johnstone has connected seemingly unrelated elements of politics, history, society, and culture in a way that only his brain is able to do. We are here to inspire intellectual curiosity, combat misinformation, and of course, entertain through education. And I am, well, just so grateful you're here. Super quick, some logistics. If you like the show, please like, share, subscribe, comment, rate, review. Anything that tickles the algorithm helps get us in front of more ear holes. And we do have a Patreon for $2 a month, less than a cup of coffee. Way less than a cup of coffee. You get an entirely extra bonus episode every month. You know you want it, so come get it. But let's not wait a second longer. Doctor, sir, professor, fellow flamingoed shirted man. We both did not plan to both be wearing flamingo shirts. So that's a little bit of visual for you guys in this audio medium. What's on the docket for today's assignment?
Jason, I know you're a foodie. I mean, you probably don't describe yourself as a foodie, but
I do. Yes.
Okay, no, I'm great. No, that's good.
Self-avowed foodie, proud foodie. Yeah.
I wanted to pick this new season up with some episodes that are about
things I care about.
Food. Yes, things you care about. After the season one finale, which was devastating. A real cliffhanger. Will Jason return for season two?
Not to say I don't care about Hitler, but it's not the way that I care about food.
Exactly. So let's talk about food, Jason.
I'm really curious how you're going to ruin this for me.
We'll see. I want you to please tell me, where in this beautiful world does authentic, traditional, a Parmesan cheese come from?
I'm going to guess Italy, but I have a feeling that because I'm going to guess Italy, I'm going to turn out to be wrong. But I think of this as being Italian.
Right. Well, I mean, officially, right, if you want to get your hands on some Parmigiano Reggiano, that is a place, that is a food item, which is a designation, origin in this world, particularly in the region of Italy called Parma.
Right? A DOP, one might say.
Correct. So, yeah, it's got that DOP distinction. Everyone thinks of true Parmesan cheese having this sort of the hard rind and the very smelly, not really that smelly, but the nutty vibe to it that you would maybe put over a bowl of pasta or maybe on a nice salad, or maybe you fold into your pestos.
Or if you're really rich, which I've never been, literally go ahead and make the pasta in the wheel of Parmesan. Oh, yeah. That's a dream.
I saw someone on TikTok the other day literally bought a wheel of Parmesan because she wanted to try that so bad. And everyone in the comments was like, wasn't that like a grand? Like, that is insanely expensive.
Oh, yeah. An entire wheel of, I mean, at least €1,000. At least €1,000 for
that's
sure.
That's a bucket list item for me. I would love to make some caucho de pepe right inside of a wheel of cheese.
That does sound nice. A lot of pepper, a lot of cheese. You have to go to Rome, though. You have to physically be in the city of Rome to make, of course, caucho de pepe. If you're going to do caucho it authentically.
Caucho de pepe. I said caucho de pepe. What? Like I'm going to Buca de Pepo. Jesus Christ.
Ooh, Buca de Pepo. Oh, Naomi, do you? Buca de Pepo is
no
not
idea.
Here. Oh, baby, that's a don't go.
Yeah, you're not missing it.
It's like sub Olive Garden, question mark. So, there's been a recent flurry of internet controversy because there's a professor named Alberto Grandi from the University of Parma who's been getting a lot of attention recently for his podcast, which is based on his 2018 book, Invented Designations of Origin, The Lies of Marketing on Typical Italian Products. Jason, can you guess where Dr. Grandi says true, authentic Parmesan cheese is actually from?
France.
No. Wisconsin.
Whoa!
So Grandi argues in his book with a number of other foods that Parmesan cheese, while there is something kind of like Parmesan cheese that existed a couple hundred years ago, actual Parmesan cheese, the way that it's made, was from Italian immigrants in Wisconsin, including one guy whose last name now would be Kraft, and that the can of Kraft shaved was like Parmesan cheese was the first Parmesan cheese, and that the Parmigiano Reggiano that we associate as true authentic Italian cheese actually comes after. So it is seeing what the Italian immigrant or Italian Americans did and being like, we can do better.
Well, they did. So props to them. Regardless of anything else that we come to in this episode.
Is there anything worse than the smell when you open a can of Kraft Parmesan cheese? It smells like a dead body.
No, yeah, there's worse things. There's Hitler. We already covered it. Go back in the archives. I will say that this is why the word authentic is not my favorite description, right, particularly when describing food. I think it's something that I've been trained out of over the years, because what the fuck does authentic really mean? There are other, yes, better, more specific words to use to describe whether it is place of origin or whether it's just a better description of the feeling, homey, home style, etc. Authentic is kind of it's kind of like using the word natural, right, where people think it has a meaning and you get a general vibe of what it means, but the reality is it's not actually a designated word to have a specific value.
And that's so he makes a couple other points similar to that, but that is like kind of Grandi's whole argument, is that this concept of authenticity.
Too bad it's not a venti argument. That would be even more compelling. By weight.
Just brush over that comment.
Yep. I'm going to trente on to something else. Anyway, yeah, so his whole argument is that these dishes, there's nothing authentic about. There's nothing actually like Italian about them. They're not traditional Italian dishes. If your meaning of traditional and authentic Italian dishes is that this is a thing which has been done in Italy in this particular way for question mark number of generations, but say at least your nonna, your grandma's grandma, so on and so forth. Because he talks about how his father, having grown up in Parma, in northern Italy, had never heard of pizza before 1956. He had had sushi before he had had pizza. And same thing with panettone was like not a thing. And then now, since the 60s, it's been huge at Christmas time for Italians, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, it is wild to think about the fact that, for example, tomatoes are not natural to Italy, or right, potatoes are not natural to Ireland, and how quickly we become accustomed to things, how quickly things become staples of a diet and a culture That doesn't mean they're any less relevant. Absolutely, those are staples of those cultural diets now, but that's within the last, 200, 300 years.
Right. And as you've already pointed out, man, Parmigiano Reggiano is way better than Kraft Parmesan cheese. Like, there's a part of me that goes, who gives a shit whether or not this is the authentic thing? I would like the delicious thing. That is what matters the most to me. But the reason he has gotten so much attention is because, and you may have figured this part out already, that authenticity and traditional label is worth 20, 30 billion euros in Italy. Like, it's a huge, huge problem because Italians really have attached an identity to this mastery over certain foods.
Do you know, they're so specific that, well, to be fair, they're actually Sicilian, but when we had some Sicilian people come and stay with us, my family, my sister used to use the kettle, obviously, to boil water. Like, in England, we boil water in a kettle, and then we use that to put into the pan that you put the pasta in. They were teaching us how to make carbonara. They were like, do not use a kettle. I can't believe you're using a kettle. And then she didn't use a kettle for years to make pasta because she thought they must have some insider knowledge. And then it turned out, we found out 3 years later, they thought she meant she was putting the pasta in the kettle.
That would be a mistake. I think that would be a bad idea.
But she trusted the word of the Sicilian so much that she was like, I will somehow boil water from scratch every time, and that's going to make a difference to the flavor.
So, trying to determine what is and what is not authentic traditional Italian food by the metrics of something that people in Italy have just been eating for more than the last century is fucking impossible. It is outrageous.
We have no interest in trying to legislate what is or isn't authentic food, particularly in Italy. That's what we call a no-win scenario.
The good news is, Jason, I'm not you, and I am ready to do exactly that. So let's try a different cuisine, a different country, a different food item, because I think I can actually get to what is and is not authentic. What are the metrics if we look at it through the lens of les croissants?
Okay, buddy. I've known you for a long time. We've known each other for over 20 years. Somehow, some way, that might be the most arrogant thing you've ever said. That I am capable of determining what authentic food is. Also, I haven't had lunch yet, so this is fucking torture.
You're welcome. You know what, Jason? Perfect segue. Take me, please, on a culinary journey. What is a croissant?
A croissant is a French laminated pastry where so much beautiful butter is folded and folded and folded over into luscious dough and baked into a crispy brown exterior with a light, fluffy interior, and all that laminated butter melts into it and also causes it to expand. So you have lots of cracks and crevices and an aerated inside. It is,
Now I'm hungry too.
I can wax rhapsodically. Yeah. About food. Did I give you what you want? It is.
You're right. You nailed it. I think any Parisian would have accepted your definition as Americanly good enough.
I do try hard to be better than Americanly good enough when it comes to food.
So when we get into the history of les croissants and how it came to be, I would say perhaps equal with the baguette. I think champagne, baguette, and croissant and like a cigarette and a beret are the symbols of France, right? How does it come to be one of the symbols of France along with fraternity and all that good stuff?
Well, have you fucking eaten one? If you made that,
they're delicious,
you would be known for it.
Hey, man, I love a croissant. I love an almond croissant specifically, although I get mine veganly from the Turks, which is its own special story.
Also technically a croissant then.
Well, in his book, David Halliday, book called The Bloody History of the Croissant, he attempted to trace the origin of this. Look at you. You're falling apart already.
The bloody, please tell me this is like colloquial bloody, like, bloody good, not the bloody history, like fucking diamonds.
Well, hold on. You'll understand why it's called the bloody history of the croissant in a second. He's tried to trace the origin of the pastry. And of course, he starts with the shape, because as I've just said, it's the most recognizable part. Crescent-shaped breads, turns out, have been made everywhere in the world for thousands of years. The earliest example, a fossilized loaf of bread in the shape of a crescent, dates back to about 2200 BC in Sumeria.
Who hasn't wanted to eat the moon?
And the Greeks classically would make crescent-shaped bread every spring in honor of the moon goddess Artemis, because it's delicious. So none of those things necessarily meet the standards of what a croissant is. They're just crescent-shaped breads, right? We don't know. I'm going to go out on a limb and say the Sumerians, who didn't have butter, weren't laminating their breads. But, like, you know, it's a little different. So the closest ancestor to the French croissant that we can find in the historical record is the Kidfell, which is made in 13th century Vienna for the first time to honor Duke Leopold, who repelled an invasion of Muslims into Byzantium during the Fifth Crusade. And the shape is meant to mock the crescent moon shape of Islam. So everyone is like, haha, fuck you Muslims. And then they eat a moon, like as if one were to make a cross and then eat it.
Or like a Hamantaschen, where we made for anyone who doesn't know, the Hamantaschen is the Jewish cookie pastry that is based on the tricorner hat of the evil villain Haman. And so then we made his hat into a cookie and we eat it. And I like Hamantaschen very much. So very much in that spirit. I don't know why there is a cultural tradition across many different cultures of taking some sort of symbology of your enemies and turning it into a pastry. That's a weird thing we'll have to unpack at some point, but clearly that's an old school technique for humiliation and domination.
Do you never make your enemies into pastries? I literally do that constantly.
I find baking intimidating. I really love cooking,
right?
But I don't love
baking's horrendous. It's like a science experiment that I don't understand.
Baking is science. Cooking is art. Cooking is art with science. It is scientific underpinnings. But baking truly, I think, is it's very much about equations. And cooking is about the vibe.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose so. I guess I don't have trouble with either of them because I'm great. So.
Enough of something completely unrelated. What is your worst baking nightmare you've had? Jason.
No, I don't do it. I do cooking projects because I am intimidated by it.
Do you know what, though? I think that, like, the worst thing with baking is you don't know how it will be till it comes out the oven, and mine inevitably always comes out flat and lifeless and sad. And then I taste it, I'm like, it tastes like shit. And now I've just baked for hours, and I didn't know it tastes like shit because you can't eat it before it's done. Makes me angry.
So for you, baking is like dating.
Yeah.
You spend 5 hours only to find out that it's limp and lifeless.
So, the Kidfell is this crescent-shaped thing. We don't 100% know that it was laminated, but it would make sense because we do know with some certainty that lamination in the form of a Danish, which, Jason, what's a Danish for those people who don't know what a Danish pastry is?
Basically, it is a croissant-like pastry with an open-faced filling.
If you don't put a drizzle of icing on your Danish, you can put it in the fucking bin. That's my opinion on Danishes. Anyway, so the Danish wasn't invented by Danes. It was invented by Viennese bakers, bakers from Vienna, who came up to Copenhagen during a strike. There were bakers were on strike for rent. They wanted rent controls. And then a bunch of guys from Vienna came up and they started making these laminated pastries. And then everyone was like, these are really good. We should start making these laminated pastries. So it makes sense. It would make sense that the croissant is from Vienna because these guys clearly cracked the lamination secret, right? But that still doesn't quite explain it because it turns out the first people to laminate a dough were the Greeks, like puff pastry.
Right, phyllo dough, yeah.
Yeah, they've been laminating for like 2700 years or something like that. You're just folding butter into dough. What we can definitely determine is that the croissant was not invented in France, right? They don't claim the croissant because they came up with the croissant. There's too many precedents of laminated doughs and crescent-shaped doughs. There's no reason to think that like a French baker came up with the croissant. And with the movement, particularly in the 16th and 17th century of like journeymen, which is like people who have studied under a master of a particular discipline, and then they go on a journey to start their own places, their own shops. Like bakers were moving across borders in that time period because borders didn't really exist. We didn't have immigration or anything. So it doesn't make sense to say that, well, the French invented the croissant. That's why it is one of their symbols.
Well, I don't want to get too deep in the weeds, but I will say, isn't it possible that someone in France was the first person to synthesize all of these disparate elements and turn it into the first thing that was called the croissant, right? Like, there's a lot of different elements that you just discussed in terms of crescent-shaped breads, in terms of lamination, in terms of other things. Just because those elements all existed in different forms doesn't necessarily mean that somebody didn't come up with what we now consider to be the croissant and sort of establish that. Because there's, you know, for example, an empanada versus a dumpling versus a knish. These are all very similar concepts, but we would say they are different. I wouldn't say that somebody else developed the knish just because they developed the dumpling, even though I would say those things are very much related. So, you know, couldn't it be possible that the croissant as we know it was invented in France, but it comes from the history of other pastries, doughs, laminations, etc.
Well, I'll say this. One, I know exactly where the empanada came from, which is that it came from Cornwall. It's just a Cornish pasty that literally was bought over by Cornish miners to South America. So it is literally just a Cornish pasty called an empanada. And then we are saying the same thing here. I'm saying it wasn't invented in France because we now need to ask the question, okay, well, how did it become a French thing?
Right.
Right. So we're heading in the same direction on this one. And there's a lot of myths on this one. One of them is that Marie Antoinette, who is from Austria, loved croissants as a child, and then she became the queen of France, and so clearly she brought it with her. And we know that that story is bullshit because it started with Marie Antoinette. And there's not a single story about Marie Antoinette that is fucking true, except she was killed.
Oh, did she never actually say, let them eat cake?
No, that is not a thing.
That's too bad.
Oddly enough. She may have, in a sentence, uttered those words, but it probably was like, oh, the guests are here. Well, yeah, let them have some cake. You know, but she did not say, you know, fuck the poor, let them eat cake. That's not a thing. There are, I checked, about 13 or 14 different origin stories in the mythology of the croissant, of how the croissant came to France, and none of them have any supporting evidence. So when we do go to hard data, when we do an n-gram search, Jason, do you know what an n-gram search is?
I'm about to find out.
It's when you look for the frequency of the appearance of a word in publications. It's one of the ways that the Oxford English Dictionary goes and tries to find out where a word came from. They go, okay, well, when did it start popping up in texts? When you do that n-gram search, you find out that the first appearance of les croissants, which is officially how you're supposed to say it in French, le croissant just means the crescent and can describe anything in the shape of a crescent. But les croissants, the plural, describes the pastry. Fun fact, will anyone misunderstand you if you say le croissant in France? No, they won't. They'll just judge you for being American.
And also, even if you say it correctly, they'll still look at you like you said it wrong.
Correct. They will detect your accent and be snooty, in Paris specifically. The first appearance of les croissants in written text is in 1853 in a publication that, when translated to English, just means foodstuffs. It's a great name for a publication. It's just some foodstuffs.
That's good.
It mentions,
that should be my new blog. Foodstuffs.
Foodstuffs. It mentions les croissants, but it doesn't really give you any details. It just says that it is a crescent-shaped baked good. The first appearance of a recipe for les croissants is in 1906 in La Nouvelle Encyclopédie Culinaire, the new encyclopedia of food. 1906, Jason, do we know what else is going on in France in 1906? Any ideas? I'll give you a clue. One of your heroes, I know that you love this guy, of the culinary world, is kicking it around in 1906.
It's not Jacques Pepin. It's the guy who created what we consider the foundational building blocks of modern day Western cuisine.
Yeah, you have. Yeah, I know who you're talking about. It's Escoffier. It's Escoffier.
Yes, thank you.
You're thinking Escoffier. Of Escoffier.
Yes.
Yes, this is the
mother
time.
Sauce Escoffier.
Oh yeah, haute cuisine. This is France, baby. This is what we call in French history, la belle époque, the beautiful time, right? This period from about mid-1870s, when the Third Republic establishes itself, and then very, very firmly ending in late July 1914 when the first shot of the First World War went off because it wasn't pretty anymore. Yeah, I think that's a fair, hard end point. The Belle Époque. Yes. So when you, the audience, Jason, Naomi, when you imagine Paris, when you think of picnics on the Seine or strolls down the Champs-Élysées or the Eiffel Tower.
I just think of Madeleine.
You think of Madeleine. Interesting.
Madeleine, yeah.
But the world, that Paris, that cafe culture Paris, is Belle Époque Paris. This is when France became synonymous with culture and class, right? When we start to think, oh, the good stuff comes from France. This is the time, the 1890s, is when champagne gets its first legal distinction, when it becomes the law in France that other wine producers are not allowed to call their wines champagne outside of the Champagne region. Again, like you said, Escoffier, he's over at the Ritz. He's doing this haute cuisine, grand cuisine, these crazy meals where he's pushing the envelope of what food can taste like in a way that no one had been doing in Europe, at least.
And codifying it is, I think, also very important.
And writing it down and being like, and I think,
and creating certain organizing principles around it. I think that's really, it's again, like a lot of people, it's not necessarily that what he is doing inherently, all of the recipes are completely innovative, though a lot of it is, but that he's creating a systematic structure around cooking that blends science and taste profiles and creating a language, which then really did come to define Western fine dining for like 100 years. I do make it a very specific point to say Western fine dining, though, because yes. there was a long period of time where it was considered the epoch of all fine dining, which really left out traditions of Africa, South America, Asia, etc., which isn't fair.
Exactly. And that's France in the Belle Epoque when you view it from the outside, right? Those are happening inside right. of France.
But
obviously, there's a lot of other shit happening.
Yeah,
in France.
There's always... Yeah.
Yeah. So, the first...
The beautiful city still has a sewer system.
Exactly. A really stinky one. God, Paris smells bad. Some of Paris smells bad. Some of parts are not so bad. But that's happening. We're getting this idea. You know, because, like, Escoffier is, like, making the menu for the Titanic. Like, it's spreading well outside of France. He's in New York. He's in London. He's all
I wouldn't put that at the top of my resume.
But, I mean, he didn't sink the ship. He's just the guy who made the cool, like, he came up with the good
food. He just made the last meal.
Yeah. But this is happening at the same time that the croissant is getting some play. It's being associated with cafes in Paris. People are perceiving that as something that is Parisian. But the real kicker, the thing that made the croissant the quintessential French breakfast item, Jason, three words, or actually two words technically, continental breakfast.
Yeah, why did you say that it was three
I
words?
Have the word I have it written down as the continental breakfast. I don't know why I came with three. But it's continental breakfast. The continental
so
breakfast.
So hotels is why everyone... Well, yes. That makes sense, actually, because then that's where tourists are coming and that's their boom. Introduction to what the culture is because that's what they're experiencing. So I answered my own question. That doesn't
yes,
make sense.
Yes, absolutely. Rapid urbanization in the United States and in Europe, particularly in Britain, in the second half of the 19th century... created this massive labor force, and that massive labor force living in urban spaces became really interested in what the Victorians called leisure time, which we just call weekends and holidays, right?
Vacations.
Exactly. Vacations. The vacation was invented at the same time as the Belle Epoque. The two have, that's why it's a beautiful period. It's the first time we're really having this idea of vacations. And so all these towns start to crop up in the US and Britain, particularly seaside towns, that are like engaging with this idea of something called tourism. And there's a lot of competition, right? Like if you build a hotel and I build a hotel, why does anyone want to come stay at your hotel versus my hotel by the sea?
The honest answer is obviously views, amenities, price, etc. But my answer is, how's the buffet?
Correct. How is the buffet? Because that is the thinking. That is where the continental breakfast comes from, is people saying, oh, if we throw in a free breakfast, right?
Yeah.
People will come to our place, even if it's not, maybe it doesn't have as good of a view, or maybe it doesn't have, it's not quite the right location, or the price is a little bit more, but we throw in a free breakfast, and we zhuzh it up, right?
I fucking love a free hotel breakfast. And I think that's pretty much the only thing that can wake me up at 7 a.m. on a holiday. And it angers me. I'm always awake about 5 minutes before the breakfast is going to end. And I run down stressed. But I'm not missing that breakfast.
No. Oh, you go to the Premier Inn. You want to get yourself like a nice little, the omelet station still open.
Yeah.
Oh, baby.
But that is not a continental breakfast.
But that's not a continental breakfast.
The continental breakfast is the budget breakfast. And I will say, I assume that the continental breakfast during the Belle Epoque is a better set of continental breakfast than I get at the Holiday Inn, because I am not a continental breakfast fan. I want the hot breakfast. If someone's,
yeah.
To me, the continental breakfast is bullshit. At least
I don't
nowadays.
Want fruit.
No, I don't
want
like
you. Fruit. I don't want to be healthy right now.
I mean, I do like the fruit, but I want eggs. I want a meat. I want some potatoes. I want the hot breakfast bar. That is what I'm here for at this hotel.
Yeah, no, Jason. The continental breakfast has not changed in 100 years. It was this. It was just. It
but
would,
their croissants
it would be...
were probably better than the ones I get at like, you know, Roanoke, Virginia.
I don't know about that, bro. The whole point was, it's a free add-on that you can use to entice customers, but you therefore want to keep the cost of making it down. And the croissant was perfect because
it feels fancy, but it's not.
Yeah, it seems fancy. Croissant, the word meaning the pastry, and continental breakfast have the same mentality behind it. It sounds classy, but in reality, it's a very simple thing. There's nothing particularly outrageous about a croissant, right?
It's marketing. Butter, both flour. Of them are marketing.
Yeah, exactly. It is marketing. And just a side note, the full English breakfast is a response to the continental breakfast. The English hate the French so much that when they encountered the continental breakfast, they had the same response that you had, which is like, fuck this shit. I want a hot breakfast. And then
we want beans on toast.
They just was like, let's just get everything that is not a pastry
and fry it up.
Not some fruit. And I want to fry it in fat and I want to just put it on a plate.
And call it a full English.
And call it a full English. This is...
So it's their version of... it's their version of freedom fries.
Correct. Yes, yes. The full English is just the freedom fries of the British Empire.
Oh, do you know, I love a full English. And now for something completely unrelated.
Let me see if I can get it. Can I try?
Yeah, okay, try.
All right. So a full English, if I understand it correctly, you're going to get... bangers, you're going to get rashers, you're going to get white pudding, black pudding, you're going to get mushrooms, tomatoes, beans on toast, some kind of taters, and then bread with butter.
I don't know what a white pudding is.
Yeah, I would say white pudding, not that common. Oh, also, I don't think black pudding...
The black pudding is correct. Hash browns would be the potato. And then you've missed off one thing, fried bread.
Yeah, good Lord, Naomi. You've gone for quite the fucking...
The full English. I'm not talking about what you're getting in the hotel. Fried bread. That is in the South. You always get fried bread with your full English.
Hold on. I think you're right, Naomi, that fried bread is more common like when you're from Sussex to points west down to Cornwall. I disagree, though. Maybe I'm crazy. I don't think the black pudding pops up so much further south. That to me is more of
a point? Northern thing. You're American.
The point is that the fry up was a response to people being like, what the fuck is this continental breakfast? I want something hot. Now, in under one sentence, explain to me, why did the British hate the French?
Oh, God. You've opened a minefield. That's not a sentence, chat.
Dead simple. I don't even need a whole sentence. 100 years war. Problem solved. It's one of the longest wars in history. That's why. So the question then becomes, Jason, which came first? The publication of the recipe of the croissant or the continental breakfast?
The continental breakfast?
Yes, the continental breakfast came first. In fact,
because that's how it popularized it. And then
after the continental breakfast establishes itself in the U.S. and in England in particular, the volume of writing about what is a croissant in French skyrockets. Because as soon as the outside world started telling the French what is a croissant, the French are like, no. We must get in there and tell them what is croissant.
Well, they want to control the narrative. I actually think that makes a ton of sense. If this item is going to become a representative sample of your culture to the outside world, you want the agency to decide what that is. Otherwise, you end up with Hawaiian pizza being what most people think of Hawaiian food, and it was invented by a Canadian. It has nothing to do with Hawaii. So, like, I totally understand why you would want to immediately, if this is going to become your identity in the world, you decide to control that narrative.
This is where the croissant becomes the croissant. It was not invented by the French. fine. Doesn't matter, right? Things don't have to be invented in a place to become associated with them. And it is specifically developed in response to outside influences, non-French people, effectively dictating what is a croissant and the French pushing back. So, is the croissant an authentic, traditional example of French cuisine? Hobsbawm's book, The Invention of Tradition, argues that in modern societies, traditions are created by partisan actors operating within their own context in order to establish authority and meaning for their cause. So when we say partisan actors, right, that term kind of gets bandied about now to mean like two party systems in a democratic or semi-democratic.
It just means someone that has an agenda.
Correct. Exactly. Thank you. It's just someone who has an agenda. So in the case of the croissant, Hobsbawm could argue that the bakers of Paris, by saying, no, real croissant cannot be made in a factory, are just trying to protect their businesses. Like, they're trying. They know that sales sales are not down. They know it's so much cheaper to buy, like, the mass-produced croissant, and you could sell it for the same price and make more money, but that doesn't fit their specific business model, so they condemn that as illegitimate.
They're protecting their intellectual property.
Correct. And this extends for Hobsbawm into a lot of different categories. Some of them relatively benign, right? So, for example, in the United States, when it was a new country, there was a rush to produce cookbooks in the 1790s about American cookery as a way to distinguish American cookery from British cookery, right? Which makes sense, because we had just fought a war against Britain and declared independence, and what is American?
Food is culture.
And the argument was
art is culture, food is culture.
Is culture, right. That if we can get an idea of what it means to be an American and to cook American food, we can start to come together as a nation. Unfortunately, all of those recipes were just from New England, and nobody cared. The ones that sort of got made initially. Because Southern cuisine was not being made by people who were necessarily literate, because the people who owned them ensured they wouldn't be. But that's one side of the equation. Grandi actually engages with Hobsbawm here when he talks about carbonara.
Remind me who Grandi is.
The author of Invented Designations of Origin that we mentioned at the beginning of the episode. I'm doing this thing where I try to connect this part back to the beginning. He talks about carbonara as the perfect example of an invented tradition. So according to the author Luca Cesari, who wrote A Brief History of Pasta, the dish was most likely invented in World War II when the U.S. forces invaded in Sicily and southern Italy, and they liberated Italy from Mussolini. If you want to interpret it that way, I think that's a pretty fair one. And he was so grateful to the invading U.S. troops because it had been so difficult for so many years under fascism and rationing and these sorts of things that he wanted to make them a celebratory dinner, and he could only offer pasta because that's what he had. And so the troops put together their rations, and those rations included bacon and powdered eggs. And he put that all together and he made carbonara. Which means that if we want to go by what is authentic carbonara as what's the original carbonara recipe, bacon, not guanciale, is technically then the authentic ingredient. Is guanciale the better ingredient? I don't know. That's up to you.
And if you want to be really annoying at a dinner party, after Jason made, if you say to someone, oh, carbonara is bacon, they say it's guanciale, say, actually, originally the recipe was bacon.
But that's the thing. I disagree with one of the premises here, and I won't sidetrack us too much, but I think that there's a difference between original and authentic. I have a personal feeling about that, because, for example, Batman Sorry, Naomi.
Oh, no. What was getting cut?
Oh, Batman.
I think authentic doesn't have to mean the original, because things have to grow into what they become. And the original version of something is not necessarily always its most authentic version. For example, Batman as a concept, at its most authentic, I think there's a lot of elements that aren't there at its very conception. They come together pretty quickly, but the most authentic version of Batman that's been pretty traditionally understood is he doesn't kill. He doesn't use guns. He has a specific costume that is entrenched in people's minds. And if you look at the first few appearances of Batman, he shoots a gun. He's got purple gloves. That first version isn't actually the most authentic version. It's the original version that grows into the most authentic version. And then the most authentic version is the one that gains the strongest foothold in history and builds up its own myth and mythology after it has a period of time to establish itself.
There you go. So the good news is, I think we mostly agree on this then, because when the guanciale and the pecorino romano and these authentic air quotes ingredients, regardless of their historicity, their historicalness, for those of you who've not heard the word historicity before, apologies, regardless of their
I love that word
historicity, they emerge not out of some cultural movement that is focused on Italianness necessarily, but rather they're influenced by an economic shift that after the Second World War, you can imagine Italy was in something of an economic slump. Happens when you lose a war and genocide people. It's not good for the economy. Is anyone from the Trump administration listening? It's not good for the economy to genocide or ethnically cleanse people. Look it up. As the 1950s goes on, Italy becomes, once again, more of an economic power, thanks in no small part to things like the Treaty of Rome, which would be the basis for the European Union 40 years later. But these things start to happen. And as the peoples of Italy have more money, they start to look to establish what consumption patterns define Italianness. And they have this story of carbonara and how it is made with rations. And it's not necessarily that they are like, ooh, that's wrong. It's that they're saying, we don't have to do that anymore. My argument is this. The words authentic and traditional are not historical. Get rid of them.
I agree completely.
They're useless.
Yep.
Croissants are not traditionally French. Parmesan is not authentically Italian. What they are, the current, like, DOP champagne has to come from the champagne region, is actually two different movements that happen to coincide at the end of the 19th century. One of them is nationalism. And I don't mean extreme ultra-nationalism. I just mean the idea of
pride in your country.
What is a nation?
And creating a sense of identity and culture. Yeah.
And, like, that really, really easily steps into fascism. Like, that's, like, on the road, but it doesn't have to. There's plenty, you know, the government in Scotland is the Scottish National Party. They represent the nation of Scotland. Are they great? No. Are they fascist? Absolutely not. They're not monsters. They're just, well, they're mostly just centrists at this point.
Well, they're just politicians. But, like,
yeah, exactly. That's one of the key things. It was people trying to establish who we are. And we tend to say culture creates a nation, but I would actually argue in the case of food, at least, the nation creates the culture. The we are French, what does it mean to be French? Oh, we eat croissants. What's a croissant? Oh, it must be made this way. Right? It's this back and forth of defining what it means to be French.
In England, it's interesting because most of our national dishes are from other countries.
What are the English? The conquerors or the colonizers. Like, they went and got your spices, brought it home, and then didn't put it on anything.
Like, yeah. So true. Yeah. We just use the salt and the pepper.
Yeah. But that's...
You guys got to curry eventually.
What? Well, you mean we stole it?
Yeah, but you started using it. Like, I feel
yeah,
like...
Yeah, I still don't put much spice in it, though.
I think... When I think of British spices, I think of salt, I think of pepper. I do also think that you put curry in a lot of things.
Yes, I know. We're taking the piss. We're taking the piss. We're having fun. That's really what defines the English nation, is its self-deprecation. I think a lot of people argue that. But the reason why these traditional cuisines emerge when they emerge, not only is it the rise of this concept of nationalism, which is a very 19th century idea that spreads into the 20th century, it's also globalization.
Right. It has to be.
As the world gets smaller and smaller and you're buying blueberries from Peru and you're like, you can eat dal and sushi and burgers and borscht. Like, what the hell am I? Right. How do I see myself in a world where there's so many options and things coming from every direction? And so what I want to put down then as my official stance on what is an authentic or traditional food, there is one authentic and traditional food in the entire world. And that's whatever you want to eat, and like whatever you can get your hands on. There is no national cuisine that is an authentic or traditional food. It is a response to changes in the world where people start to establish their identities. And the moment you start to enforce those rules in a way in which you other people, in which you say things like, oh, that is not a croissant, that is not authentic, that is not traditional, that is wrong, that I guess is authentically mean, but like it's not authentically a tradition. It is not a tradition because all of these, every single national cuisine in my research dates back to maybe 1871.
I would say I hear what you're saying, and in a utopian idea, I think I agree with you. I think that is more, if I'm being fully honest, I think that is a very Andrew Johnstone moral view of the world rather than a more actual appraisal of what it is based on how society has come to assess it. So I think that this is one of those cases where what you just said, while I hear you, is aspirational, and I appreciate where you're coming from. I think my takeaway would be that traditions are often rigged, not necessarily organic, but that the stories that we tell about ourselves become the truth because perception is reality. And so what is authentic is not invalid, but it is also not immutable. What is authentic at one point can change and adjust and has to inherently, but what is regionally celebrated and what is regionally recognized as the way is what is at that time authentic, but that doesn't mean that it won't change or that it hasn't already changed or that something else is bad. Again, I will say I think the word authentic is fucking problematic.
Yes.
And regionally specific is a much better way of putting it, which is that there are, I think, regional foods. Like the cheesesteak is regionally celebrated in Philadelphia. It's not the only place that you can get it, but that is considered a regional delicacy. Mock turtle soup is regionally celebrated in Cincinnati. It's by far not the only place you can get it. And I love that as someone who loves regional foods, because I do think you learn about the culture. I think that the stories that people tell about their areas through food is interesting and valid. And the only way you could tell a story is not by being exclusive by saying, hey, you're not welcome, but by saying, this is what this is. And inherently, that means it can't be some other things.
Do you know what's interesting is there's like a lot of stuff online about this recently with baked potatoes. So like a jacket potato in England is very specific. You have it with like beans and cheese, or you have it with tuna and stuff. And it's blown up loads recently because like Spud Bros and these like food vans.
Really quick. Did you say you have it with tuna?
Yeah, baby.
Yeah.
You put a
tuna mayo.
Salad on your jacket potato.
Tuna mayo and cheese.
I don't want to derail too much, but what the fuck?
Yeah, it's fucking delicious.
Is it really? I've never heard of that. Is
it's
it like
so like, good. I'll like send you a video of it.
Canned tuna?
Yeah. Tuna salad.
In a baked
tuna
potato?
Tuna mayo. In a baked potato with cheese. So good.
I've
like
not
a tuna
heard
melt,
before.
But on a potato.
Yeah, it's a tuna melt, basically.
So yeah, all the Americans are floored by it. And there's these like big food vans that have got really big on social media that just sell jacket potatoes.
It does sound gross, but many things that sound gross taste great. So it's probably just a cultural difference. But I would need to see the preparation.
Well, loads of people, Americans, have come onto TikTok and they're trying to recreate these jacket potatoes because they can't get them in America. And all the comments are like, you put the butter on wrong. You mashed the fork in wrong. You didn't do this. You didn't let the cheese melt. You should have put mozzarella on it. And I was like, I've never put mozzarella on a jacket potato. And it's like, everyone has a different, like, nothing an American ever does with a jacket potato will be right to an English person.
No.
And I think people take it too far to the point where you're like, you just want to seem like you have this regional knowledge because you're from England that you can make a jacket potato better.
My big takeaway is something I believed anyways, which isn't to say that this wasn't valid. It's that this is even a more robust examination of why I think the word authentic is not a useful word to describe food. It's really not good. I've heard this for a long time and I completely agree. And I don't think traditional is bad either. I think it's okay to say that certain things are things. I think that it is what I hear you being very rubbed against, and I agree, is people for whom there is a moral judgment about you're doing something different than I'm doing. I do think there is some value in defining things and allowing things both grow and change and evolve over time, but that also words have meaning and meaning have power. And when people have determined a definition for something and it has a particular value for their culture, that can grow into something that actually they take great pride in. And when other people misrepresent that, they feel the need to protect it, in part because we know that that stuff can change. And sometimes that stuff can change in ways that are very bad. And you can lose something that you care about and believe strongly in, and all of which is to say that much like anything that has to do with society or personal identity and cultural identity, I think it's far more complicated than any one specific truth. The biggest thing that I learned today was that the English breakfast is a fucking response to the continental breakfast as a big cultural fuck you. Incredible. These are the food feuds that I could get behind. Do I want 100 years wards? No. Do I want to engage in all sorts of different kinds of breakfast because countries said, fuck off, I can do it better? Absolutely. That's the kind of like, that's the kind of a free market capitalism that I actually want.
Jason is looking for a breakfast proliferation engagement. He wants mutual assured deliciousness.
That's exactly right. I fuck the arms race. We need to settle our goddamn beefs by cooking beef. You know what I mean? Like Iron Chef for war.
Honestly, you know, it'll settle a lot of these debates, won't it?
Pure taste. Andrew. Anything about the research of this episode that you want to share behind the scenes?
So as I mentioned earlier in the episode, ngram searches. So if you just go ahead, I don't like to plug Google Books, but if you look at something like Google Books, you can easily do this in English. And you can just sort of look for terms. So Google's ngram viewer allows you to just type in a word. So, for example, Frankenstein, right? If you want to look up the book, the word Frankenstein and its prevalence, the number of times that it appears, you can just type that in and it'll show you from 1800 to 2022 what's the most popular year for Frankenstein. Turns out it's 2016. I don't know why it's 2016, but that is a little bit that you can learn. So it's just a good way to find out, when does this term I'm trying to understand enter the lexicon, become part of the conversation, as opposed to when is it sort of maybe a thing, but we don't know? Ngram searches.
And if you want to learn how I completely abused Google Books during my degree, then you can go back to our previous episode.
That is the bonus episode on Patreon. You gotta pay. You gotta pay to find out how Naomi used to barely pass uni.
Awesome. Naomi, do you have any final thoughts?
I think I need to make you a tuna jacket potato.
Yeah.
I learned about tuna jacket potatoes. I did not know about those, and I am genuinely interested in trying them because I love to try different foods, and as a man that eats organ meat, I'm open to anything.
Yeah. Stunning.
I don't always melt the cheese on my jacket potatoes. I don't know why that's like...
Well, you're wrong.
No better way to wrap up than that. Thank you so much for joining us as we begin season two of Seemingly Unrelated. Remember to check out our Patreon, where we do have bonus episodes coming out for you every month. This month's will be similarly food themed. So if you're interested in more of our hot takes on hot buffets, go ahead and try that out. Please like, share, subscribe, leave a comment. And of course, most importantly, stay curious.
Au revoir.
I don't know any French words. Bye.
Seemingly Unrelated is a Life's Little Murder Boards production. Created and hosted by Andrew Johnstone and Jason Howard. Audio production and editing services provided by Naomi Cohn. Our artwork is by Megan Zemet. The theme song is Irizumi by Pistol Jazz. To find out more about everyone involved and access the show notes for this episode, visit us at seeminglyunrelatedpod.com.
Should make Rent 2 the musical. We're not gonna bake. We're not gonna bake last year's dough. This year's dough. Danish, Danish croissant ho.
That was amazing.